Hi, I'm Luke, and I'm the founding partner of the Mission Wealth Management Group at UBS, where we work with entrepreneurs of growth companies. I have always had a deep level of respect for entrepreneurs, how they have had such bold ideas, risked everything to see it through. For the better part of the past 20 years, I have made it my mission to meet, learn from, and work with passionate entrepreneurs, and have had a blast doing so. The purpose of this podcast is to showcase various entrepreneurs who have given me inspiration, allowing us to peek inside their minds and to learn what has caused them to create these businesses, share the highs and lows they've experienced, and learn where they draw their inspiration. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Entrepreneurial Insights. Today, we have the good pleasure of having the co-founder and CEO of MIM Computing, Mr. John Bean, with us. Good afternoon, John.
Hey, Luke. Great to be on board with you.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you. So, John, I know you've had a very illustrious career as a entrepreneur. And on this podcast, we've had entrepreneurs of all sizes and shapes and different parts of their entrepreneurial career. I was hoping to start, you know, because you have started and exited several different companies, I was hoping you could share with us a couple things. First of all, how you were initially bit by the entrepreneurial bug. I know you consider yourself a serial entrepreneur. And then, you know, what the journey has looked like through some of these startups. Startups and exits and kind of where we are now. With that said, if you can enlighten us.
Yeah. Before I joined a startup, I was working for a large, you know, multinational company. And actually, prior to that, my first job out of school was with a small think tank. And, you know, we were able to work hard and we're working on really good stuff. And then when I went to work for a very large company, I found that it was actually hard to actually do 40 hours a week because you're so limited, or I was so limited at this company. I couldn't do things that were outside of my scope because it's like, oh, you'd be stepping on other people's toes. That's their job, regardless of whether or not the work was getting done. And so wasn't thrilled and, you know, was willing to consider other potentials or other offers. And somebody approached me about this startup. I'd never done a startup before, and it sounded really exciting. It was Pixis. I was in Orange County at the time, and Pixis was in San Diego. And I came down and interviewed with them and just fell in love with the people, the company, what they were trying to accomplish, and ended up joining the company and was telling friends back at the old company how I'm working 60, 70 hours a week and they pay me less, but I'm thrilled. And the bug that I caught was the fact that you're working with a bunch of people that are all in it for the same reason. You know, they're in it to win it. They're all type A personalities. Everybody works extremely hard and is very skilled at what they do typically. And it's also kind of a family type atmosphere because you work so long and work so hard. You spend more time with your coworkers than you do with your family during a normal week. It was just something that I gravitated towards and have, you know, loved to. And there's also something about the risk, you know, that you sort of can live and die by the moment. And for some reason that appealed to me because it was more than a paycheck. You understand that there's risk, but you're also excited about the upside potential of where things could go if you are successful with the company.
Sure. So almost that level of excitement and seeing what your work is actually doing. Sometimes if you're one cog in the wheel, you kind of are so focused on that one project or your one avenue there. Whereas if going to a startup, you really see what you're working towards. And that I can see that being exciting. Now, from Pixis, where did your entrepreneurial journey take you?
Yeah, so while I was at Pixis, I was approached by another startup in San Diego called Bridge Medical. And by the time I left Pixis, I was director level, ended up becoming a VP for Bridge Medical. And I was in my 30s, early 30s, and was really honored by that because the other VPs and executives were all in their 50s. And it was another opportunity. But the Pixis was a healthcare product. Actually, it's what we called an ATM for drugs. It's a drug cabinet, so to speak, that works like an ATM. Nurses can get out medications just using their thumbprint, actually. And then Bridge Medical was designed to have a product that was by the patient bedside in order to validate the medications before a patient got it, was given either a pill or a shot or something put in the IV, just to ensure that it was the right patient, the right medication, the right time and the right dosage, and there would be no adverse effects. So it was another thing in the healthcare field and was very, very exciting to work on.
Yeah, that sounds like a interesting company. And then did you stay with that through an acquisition or did you leave before that?
I left before the acquisition. That company was kind of an up and down type of experience. So the company struggled. We raised lots of money. We raised about $100 million and over number of rounds and were struggling to really get the product fully launched. There were competitive products that came up from much larger companies that really challenged us. And during the process of raising all that money, some new investors came in that essentially over time got rid of the old guard. So the original executives and all. And so I was one of those that was ultimately asked to leave. And it was a very interesting thing because it was a mentally draining process where being a young 30-something VP with a bunch of older, experienced people, I felt that I wasn't really given all my due. And I felt like by the time I left, I actually was questioning my capabilities because I kind of was drugged down by them. So that was interesting. And then after leaving that, you're always soul searching. But then another startup came to interview me, a company called CardioNow. So then I thought, okay, I need to go in and I need to tell this guy what my capabilities are, what they aren't. I felt with, Bridge, maybe part of the reason why Bridge wasn't a huge success was, and Bridge did ultimately get acquired, that, maybe there was a portion of that that was my fault. So I met with the new CEO and I was trying to explain what I thought I was good at, where I thought I might have weaknesses and stuff. And he said, "You don't understand. That's the reason why we like you, because you have arrows in your back." And it was a lesson that I had learned and have really glommed onto since then is quite honestly, because Pixis was a huge success, I should mention. And so then going from a huge success to one that was, it maybe questioned my own capabilities. So when I left it, I felt terrible, right? I thought this was the worst experience of my life. But then within 6 months, and especially after joining the new company, I realized, no, that was the best experience in your life. That was a real learning experience. And since then, I've really recognized that, I've learned more from my failures than I have from my success.
Absolutely. No, we hear that all the time, that oftentimes that shapes people's, first of all, it toughens you up a little bit, right? But also you kind of learn the ropes. At this point in your career already, you've seen the upside and the dark side of kind of startup life, right? Yeah. And then after CardioNow, is that where'd we go next?
So then I consulted to a number of startups, spoke to a number of different startups, but I didn't see them. I didn't have the passion for them, but I had the technical ability to help them. So I consulted to a number of startups probably for about a year and then ended up connecting with a ex-colleague of mine from Pixis. And where Pixis was an ATM for drugs in hospitals, we thought, hey, what about an ATM for drugs in retail pharmacy? So it's a completely different product and one that we've got lots of patents over. So then essentially my colleague and I co-founded together, and this is the first company I co-founded, was a company called Asteris. And Asteris, has these you can kind of think of it like a vending machine, but it's not really, because the difference is in pharmacy, you and I could actually have the exact same medication, the same strength, the same number of pills in our bottle and what have you, but you can't get my medication, I can't get yours, because in retail pharmacy, the prescriptions have to have a label on them. It's got to be labeled by a pharmacist. And so you can't get mine, because then with HIPAA regulations, you'd know what medications I'm on, and vice versa. So the machine that we ended up designing this new and inventing this new machine, that's kind of a random access, vending machine. So think of it like if you go to a vending machine you see today, and if there are three, let's say, Snickers bars in front of a Reese's cup, and you really want the Reese's cup. Well, the only way to get that is for somebody to buy those Snickers bars before you can get access to the Reese's cup. Well, that's a big problem if that Reese's cup happens to be your heart medicine. So we had to come up with a, robotic mechanism to deliver the Reese's cup to you whenever you came and in whatever order you got to visit the machine. So that was also very, very exciting. And it's a great product. And they're still out there. They're still private and still growing.
That's great. And then, yes, I, for one, would be furious if I couldn't get to my Reese's peanut butter cup. So I can imagine if it is your your heart medication. And then from there, your ATM career continued, right?
Yes. So then while I was still there, some friends of mine, mutual friends too, there was a company called EcoATM, wasn't called EcoATM at the time, but there were the founders that were trying to start up EcoATM. And EcoATM is a device device to take back your old cell phones and essentially pay. The reason why it's called an ATM is because it'll take it back and pay you on the spot. Essentially, you bring your phone to the machine and it'll analyze your phone and provide you with a value, so a price that it will pay you. And then if you like it, you can take the price and it'll pay you in cash. It'll spit the cash out. If you don't like it, you can take your phone back. And the whole idea was that at the time, so this was, 2008, late 2008, early 2009, nobody was really recycling cell phones. So we all had drawers full of our old cell phones as we upgraded to the next version. Nobody knew what to do with the old cell phones. And these founders realized that, hey, you know, there's a lot of electronics and things that are recyclable, you know, all the metals and what have you that are, you know, in these phones. And some of them can be refurbished. They're perfectly fine. You know, most people might want to be upgrading. There are people who may not be able to afford a brand new smartphone or what have you. So anyway, so when I joined them, so I was introduced to them before they had done anything and kind of joined them as an advisor because I had the experience of making different types of ATM type machines. So, you know, robotic machines. And what ended up happening was it was so exciting. I started moonlighting for the company. And so while I was still working at Asteris, who was working, you know, normal hours, I'd come home and spend a couple hours with my wife and my young daughter at the time. And then I would get on Skype with a team in India because they were 12 and a half hours ahead of us. And I'd work with them to develop the software for the EcoATM machine and stay up with them until about 2 a.m. and then repeat that. And what was actually really interesting is, and I still don't know how I did it, is that Asteris at the time, we were opening up Europe for Asteris. And so I was actually traveling to Europe every 6 weeks for 1 or 2 weeks and still doing that while working two essentially full-time startup jobs and with a, you know, young 2-year-old daughter at home that I also, you know, tried to give some attention to and also, of course, my wife as well. And so that was really, you know, interesting time and just super exciting. Everything was moving quickly on both sides. And then what ended up happening is EcoATM got funded and the CEO there said, look, you need to make a decision. You either need to quit EcoATM and go back to your other company and give them your full time, or you need to come work for us full time. And I ended up deciding that, you know, I was a co-founder at Asteris. Asteris was my baby. I hated to leave it, and you hate to leave the people more than anything else. But it's like, well, if I look at it from an investment perspective, I already have a lot of stock for Asteris, and I will get a lot of stock for EcoATM. And if you kind of consider the risk, well, if one of them succeeds and one of them fails, you'll never know which one beforehand, then at least I'll have made something on the outside from one of them. Hmm. If they both succeed, then even better. If neither succeed, then nothing ventured, nothing gained. And so I ended up going with EcoATM, and EcoATM became another huge success.
Absolutely. So you stayed with EcoATM through acquisition, correct?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So we were acquired by a company called Outer Wall, who was the owner of Redbox and Coinstar type devices. And they saw EcoATM as a great addition to what they were doing. And so they acquired us for $350 million in 2013.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd say that's a successful exit there. So after EcoATM, you know, before we get into MIM, was there any other startup positions? I know you were working with UCSD as entrepreneur in residence, correct?
Correct. No other startups. I went, you know, kind of left EcoATM. I thought I was kind of semi-retired, but UCSD had approached me about the entrepreneur in residence position. Gotcha. And that was extremely enticing.
Okay. And I know that kind of leads into MIM. Before we go there, so Pyxis to Bridge Medical to CardioNow, Asteris and EcoATM kind of in parallel. That's a good amount of startups to be co-founding or going to work with and seeing them through. What lessons can you derive from that? What were some of the biggest challenges that you faced or the companies faced in those issues? Does history repeat itself or does it rhyme? Are there certain things that you have found were kind of recurring issues, challenges for you?
Yeah, so actually what's really interesting about every one of those companies is that none of them from the beginning, there was no market. They were defining a new market for technology that didn't exist, and the technology didn't exist. So I was joining these companies before the technology really existed as well. So we had to build new technology that hadn't been built, and we had to build a market. And so we were, you know, we started from scratch in each one of these companies, you know, from the ground up. And, you know, in hindsight, that's one of the things that really excites me, too. And I think one of the things that drew me to each of these companies is the fact that none of it had ever been done before. I really, you know, like the challenge in all aspects.
Venturing into the unknown, if you will.
Yeah.
Great. And so that leads us to MEM Computing. If you could tell us a little bit about, you know, how you came about forming or founding MEM. I follow your progress closely, and I know you guys have a lot of interesting stuff going on that we'll get into. But how did the company form? What is it? What do they do? You know, please don't talk too techy, or my little tiny brain will implode, though.
Sure. So, yeah, so I joined UCSD as an entrepreneur in residence. And I really saw that as just a great opportunity to be kind of semi-retired. They only wanted like 10 hours a month from me. And, you know, it was office hours. You know, I had an office in on the university. One of the biggest benefits that I got was I got a special parking permit that let me park anywhere. I could even park in loading zones. So there was nothing more valuable than that at the university, because parking is such a pain.
Yeah, I was going to say, especially on that campus, that's a lottery ticket right there.
It was. And it was, you know, we did the work for a pittance that wasn't for the money. And it was really, you know, also for the glory of working with insane, you know, I'd always worked with very smart people, and I was be able to continue that by working at the university with insanely smart people that had business ideas, and they just didn't know how to commercialize. So head office hours, and would meet different staff there, that some of them, you know, professors and whatnot, that had business ideas. There were undergraduate students, there were graduate students, and a variety of those, and I would advise them. But then at one point, I was introduced to the two inventors of the MEM computing technology, Dr. Fabio Traversa and Dr. Max DeVentra. And Max is a professor of physics there, and Fabio was at the time a staff scientist, essentially working for the university. And they had invented this technology called MEM computing, which is a whole new compute architecture that, you know, their backgrounds were that they understood quantum computing and electronics and, you know, current computers and what have you. And they decided, what if we were to go back to the drawing board and build a computer using silicon-based technology, which quantum isn't. Quantum is a whole new paradigm. But they were to go back and design it from scratch, knowing what we know today. And so they created this new architecture called MEM computing that basically looked to be able to, you know, deliver the performance that's expected of quantum computing. So for those who know about quantum computing, it's still in its infancy, but seen as the next generation in computing. Well, they came up with this MEM computing technology that really looked like the next generation computing and available now. At the time that I met them, it was all theory. They had, you know, the scientific documents behind it and everything, but had not built anything yet. And the challenge they were having was that they weren't able to get any more grants to work on the technology. And as physicists, they live and die off of grants. And they can get grants as, you know, they're theoretical physicists, they're brilliant minds. And they could get grants for something else if, you know, whatever was of interest at the time, and they would have put this technology on the shelf. And my issue was, I just didn't want to see this get put on the shelf, because it looked like it was really the next generation. And if you put it on a shelf, who knows when or if the world would ever see that technology. So the three of us worked together. We got along really well, very like mindsets, and decided to spin the technology out with the blessing of the university and form the company and attempt to commercialize it.
Great. No. Please forgive me, but if for those, including myself, that don't fully understand what quantum computing is, if you can kind of elaborate. I hear it, and I think it's a Scott Bakula spinoff show.
So quantum computing, it's a new physics-based approach where, let's say that they're trying to harness the power of electrons, and I'm probably a physicist the world over, probably rolling their eyes, but the way that I see it from a layman's terms is they're really trying to harness the power of the atom and electrons to do the computing for you. And there's some real special capabilities that theoretically are possible, and the performance and speed is just insane because it's at the speed of your atoms and your electrons. The issue, though, is that harnessing this power is a physics challenge, and they've essentially been working on it for the past 20, 30 years and only been able to make the smallest of quantum computers. If you could make a large quantum computer, it would be outrageous. It would be able to solve virtually any problem in almost real time. But the challenge is that right now, and for the foreseeable future, the size of the quantum computer that they can build is less powerful than your laptop even. So it's just not able to address problems of any size, especially something that industry would need. However, there's been this mindset that that's the only way to do it, that everything else has been tried, and that the next generation is quantum, and we really have to put all of this behind it. But that's not the case. No one had thought of MEM computing and what MEM computing is until Max Deventer and Fabio Traversa came around and designed this, you know, invented this new technology. And part of the reason is because all of the new work on computing has been done by computer scientists and electrical engineers. And the difference is that these guys are physicists, and physicists essentially have to learn all those disciplines. And because of physics, that's the approach they took. They kind of stepped back and said, look, current computers aren't taking advantage of all the physics that's available to them from how electronics can ultimately work. And so they created ways to fully use all the capabilities of the electronics that aren't, it's not being used today. And essentially MEM computing, so all those great things I said about quantum, to be able to solve large problems in a fraction of the time, MEM computing is actually delivering that today.
Now, you mentioned industry. So what are the applications of this technology? What type of companies, industries are your customers, are you marketing towards?
Yeah, so I should mention too that so with MEM computing as a computer architecture, you know, essentially it represents new chips. Now, what's interesting about MEM computing, and it's never been done before, is that we've actually built a virtual MEM computer. So it's, instead of building new chips, we've actually, through software, built the technology on top of CPUs and GPUs. So we've written the code so it's very close to the metal, what they call close to the metal, so that we're just almost residing on the chip itself. So we're kind of maximizing the capabilities with our virtual MEM computing machine of current technology. So we haven't built a chip yet, although we've started some work on chip designs, and chips for the could serve, you know, image processing, communications, help with 5G communications, other areas like that that we're looking at. But for the virtual MEM computing machine, the first area we've approached are what they call optimization problems. And we know those as routing and scheduling type problems. So if you think of like your UPS, FedEx, and Amazon and their daily deliveries of packages from trucks, each of those trucks has about 120 deliveries to make on a daily basis. And with current computers, it's actually impossible in a reasonable time frame. It would actually take thousands, if not millions of years, believe it or not, to compute an optimal route for that those deliveries. It's just go into a long, detailed mathematical explanation as to why, but that is the case, and they all know it. They build approximations. Well, UPS has said that if they can save 1 mile per vehicle per day for a year with all the vehicles they have in North America, they would save $50 million a year. Wow. And so they're constantly working to improve their approximations by even a fraction of a percent on an annual basis. And they've got, you know, rooms full of PhD mathematicians and physicists that are, and data scientists that are constantly working to improve this stuff. Well, MEM computing actually can overcome. So our first product, our virtual MEM computing machine, can overcome this issue with current technology. And we can actually solve those problems that would take current computers years. We can actually provide optimal solutions for this in minutes or even seconds, depending on the problem set. So the markets that we've gone after have been transportation logistics. So we've done work for railroad companies on scheduling trains, for airlines in optimizing loading of cargo and scheduling aircraft as well, and with shipping, last mile deliveries. I mean, for trucking and in shipping, we've done port optimization problems and things of that nature. So we've touched virtually every form of transportation logistics. And then great market for us has been oil and gas, and they have, the scale of those organizations is amazing. They're dealing with billions of dollars worth of crude oil, and they have all these scheduling challenges and distribution challenges. And, we've been able to show a number of oil and gas companies that with our technology, we can give them optimal solutions. And these solutions are shown to save them, as much as, $50 to $100 million a year, because it's that's the difference between an optimal solution and approximation. And then most recently, we've gotten involved with the Air Force. And right now, one of the things we're working on is the optimization of tracking a moving target from a satellite in order to get the information to the warfighter as quickly as possible. So you think of like a missile has a travel time of 3 to 10 minutes to get to wherever it's going to do its harm. And it can be picked up by a satellite, but you've got to be able to crunch all that information in order to get it back to the warfighter, who could then issue something to shoot it down. So that's some of the technology that, some of the things that we're working on today.
Sure. So when you're dealing in, success for you guys is measured in seconds, right? Compared to what problems that have taken minutes, hours, days, months, years to accomplish. How do you go about charging these customers or partners? Is it on a project-based fee based on the value you're providing? How does that work?
Yeah, so there's a number of ways. It depends on the project. So in a number of cases, we're essentially doing what they call a proof of concept, where they come to us with these problems that were once impossible, or really the technical term is intractable, because they could be computed. You just don't have the years and years and years to wait. So for those, we'll do we'll do a fixed project based pricing for them to show them how the technology can solve that problem. And then essentially the next step is to move that to a commercial solution. So first you kind of prove it. And then secondly, you kind of have to make it production ready and high quality and robust. And so that ends up being a commercial solution. And for the commercial solutions, that we do charge what is called value pricing. So for how much money I save you, I'm going to take some percentage of that. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is that we've released our virtual MIM computing machine as a cloud-based accessible solution. So if you have the mathematicians and people on board that can build the mathematical problems that it is that we're solving, then you don't need us to do the work, and you can actually access the solution yourself and do it yourself. So that's the case with a number of companies where they're already solving problems today. They do it in the same format that our technology uses to solve. We're essentially using a format that was developed by IBM back in the 70s. So everybody's really familiar with it, and they build these mathematical models, and they can run them that they're running today, whatever solution that they're using, and they can just take that and upload it to our virtual MIM computing machine on the cloud and get that answer back in just a fraction of the time that it may take them today.
So with MIM now, where are you guys at this moment in the company's formation, right? Where are you now? What are some of the things you're focused on, and where do you see things going from here? What lies ahead in the near future?
Yeah, so as a startup organization, we're considered in a seed stage. So a seed stage is we've raised some initial money to build the technology, prove out the technology, and then our next step is to raise a Series A. So that's your first equity raise with venture capital that is usually a very large number in order to then grow your team. So we're less than 10 people today. We're pitching to get a Series A. With a Series A that will probably take us 2 years out, we'll grow by 3x. We'll grow to 30 some odd people in that period of time. And that's primarily to really flesh out this technology. As I said, we're working on some chips, or we've done some early feasibility studies on certain chips that we could build with this technology. And that's something that we're going to need serious funding behind to build the, you know, to build those as well. And so the whole idea is to get into the growth stage where we can completely flesh out our virtual MEM computing machine and actually develop. There's other applications we can develop virtual MEM computing machines for, and then there's chips that we ultimately want to get into. So we're going to be a very well-rounded company, but we need funding to get there. And so that's sort of where we are now, is we're out pitching and trying to find venture capital that is interested in funding us with a Series A.
Sure. So fair to say you're you know, having conversations with VCs, trying to get exposure for the company, proving the technology works, you know, that kind of, that's where we're currently are at this moment.
Yes.
Okay. And, you know, one question I've been asking everybody, just because, you know, the last 15 months, you know, we've all been dealing with it. I know with a company like yours, it might be a little bit different than others out there, but, you know, how has COVID helped or hurt the growth of the company? Have you had to pivot at all, being a tech company, or not?
Well, we haven't had to pivot, but at the end of 2019, the beginning of 2020, we actually were very close as a relative term. We were raising our first Series A, and it looked like there was a very high likelihood that we're going to be able to raise it in 2020. And then COVID hit, and it really threw that to the side. Our focus then had to become on kind of on survival, right? Making it through. Now, we did have quite a few projects, paid projects that we were working on in the beginning of 2020, and seemed like, okay, we're probably going to make it out of this year relatively unscathed. But then what ended up happening is, because all of our industry partners, our clients, are extremely large companies, many of them are in oil and gas, those markets were just devastated, went through major reorganizations, and they had furloughs, all kinds of issues that really put the work of MEM computing on the sidelines. So the good news for MEM computing is we actually ended 2020 stronger than 2019. So we continued to grow, continued to gain credibility and clients, but many projects were delayed. Our ultimate revenue was much lower than we expected it to be for 2020 because many projects were put on hold. But then what happened is everybody started coming out of COVID sort of towards the end of 2020. And at least from an industry perspective, they had gone through their pain and were starting to turn around and look back at projects and applications. And so while 2020 was weaker than expected, 2021 is off to a booming start and is looking like it's going to be twice as strong as we expected originally. So we paid the price in 2020, but 2021 is really looking like it's going to be a banner year for us.
Gotcha. So kind of the capital spigots, so to speak, were turned off temporarily. Some of the customers were tightening the belt because their industries were getting hit, and all this unknown just kind of hit the pause button, for lack of a better word.
It didn't, that we still had plenty of work to do. We just weren't getting a lot of new work, but we had plenty of work that we had already that kind of sustained us through the year, but it just sustained us versus telling us forward, let's say. Since we're less than 10 people, we weren't hurt that badly from a productivity perspective. We all started working from home in March of 2020 and are still working from home today, although we hope that sometime this summer we'll bring people back in force. But because we're small, we just moved all of our interactions to Zoom, daily meetings with everybody involved so that everybody can know what's going on and share what they're doing. And then individually, people working together on projects then have their own individual calls. And we've, in some ways, we may have gained some productivity because being scientists and engineers, you know, they tend to get up, you know, roll out of bed, have a cup of coffee, go sit in front of the computer and immediately start working. So without, you know, the commute time and stuff, we may have gained some additional productivity, but you lose some too, because you certainly do lose some of the, you know, the benefits you get stuff that don't necessarily happen remotely.
Sure. What about, I know you're a big culture guy, and was that difficult, like having such a high growth company where you're adding headcount almost exponentially during the midst of this when everyone's working remotely? How are you able to impose, if that's the right word, you know, the culture, the company culture on people if no one's face to face?
Well, we actually didn't grow during that time. We it's the same team that has been working together. So we're already really close. You know, it was a tough time for everyone. And so, you know, during our daily call, it's not just all business. There's probably more laughter going on than talk, because we're always goofing around and also dealing with, you know, making sure we understand if people are having other hardships or what have you.
Sure.
So we it's a very personal conversation as well as an update as to what's going on. Another thing that I did was, prior to COVID, we would take a day off, or maybe more, half a day off once a month, in order to go do things as a team outside of work. Because engineers and scientists, they just don't know how to decompress, and they'll just work themselves to death. So we would go bowling, or go to a movie together, or go to a baseball game, or do something like that. Well, obviously that stopped with COVID, but then instead what I started doing was sending everybody, since I didn't have to spend the money on those other things, instead I sent every month we've had some kind of a care package that has gone out. And that's one of the things that we all joke about and talk about. It's, you know, it's been big tubs of popcorn or pretzels. Or even, you know, one time it was Cuban sandwiches from a restaurant that ships across the country, and a bunch of different things. So we've continued that. In fact, now that it's May, I've got to figure out what we're going to do for May. But it's always trying to do something different and something fun.
Mm-hmm. That's great. And then, you know, before we wrap up here, for our listeners, you know, that are either aspiring business owners or entrepreneurs that might be struggling a little bit, what words of wisdom could you instill on them, or where'd you draw inspiration from to get through the, you know, the ups and downs of being an entrepreneur?
Yeah, you know, it's not for everybody. I tend not to worry about things that I can't control. And there's always something happening to you as in a startup world. And in fact, I call it the sine wave from hell. That's a mathematical term. You can think of instead a roller coaster from hell. Because what happens is, you come in one day and you're talking to a client and they are jazzed about what you have. They're ready to move on to the next stage, and it's going to be a big contract, let's say. Well, then the next morning you get in and they had some kind of issue in the public domain, and now they have to focus on that. And all of a sudden, so the day before, you're at the top of the roller coaster. It's like, yeah, we're going to be huge. This company is going to be the greatest since anything. And then the next day you come in and it's like, oh no, we're all going to die. We're going to have to close shop. And the next day, you have something else that's high, and then you have a low, and you just have to be able to ride that roller coaster and pay attention to the fact that the hills are getting higher. So you're, even as you're growing, you're having ups and downs, but there's still kind of a upward motion to the plane that you're traveling in. And, you know, the biggest thing is just to be able to deal with that and not freak out. And those things are going to happen. And the biggest thing is that, you know, from a client perspective, I always try to make sure I'm working with a much larger number of clients than I could really handle if they all said yes. Mm-hmm. And it's mainly because you need to do that, because somebody that you're moving very quickly with and it looks great, all of a sudden is going to fall off. Mm-hmm. It's going really slow. Do you think, oh, it's going to take forever? All of a sudden can turn around and get hot.
Sure.
So you just have a lot of irons in the fire, and they're all going to be at different stages, and just hopefully together they're all moving you upward, even if they're not all moving as quickly, and even if some burn out.
Sure. So maybe monitoring your blood pressure and your bandwidth at the same time. Is that?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, before we wrap up, two quick questions. First of all, how can people get a hold of you or check the progress of MIM and see what you guys are up to?
Yeah, so our website, you can go to mimcomputing.com, or we also have a shortcut of mimcpu.com. You can find us on LinkedIn. We share a lot of information on LinkedIn. My email is jbean, J-B as in boy, E-A-N-E, at mimcpu.com. Feel free to email me, and I'll be happy to follow up. Or link with me on LinkedIn. Yeah, we're out there. In fact, our website is, we have everything on our website if you want to learn about MEM computing. We have our scientific papers, we have our case studies, white papers, other podcasts that I've done interviews on. Those are those are out there too.
And, although those might be for the more tech-savvy crowd, right? Yeah, and I will put in a plug for looking at some of your stuff on YouTube. I found some fascinating stuff on just some of the problems you guys have been solving and compared to how long it previously took. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I did a number of videos because the technology is so deep. The science is so deep. It's really hard to understand. So we tried to create some videos that help people understand better from a layperson's terms just what MEM computing really is.
And last question for you, working with Max and Fabio, you know, a couple good Italian guys, what's their personal favorite Italian restaurant here in town, here in San Diego? That's the hard hitting questions for last.
Yeah. They've told me, but we haven't gone, it's been over a year since I've been out to a restaurant. So I don't even remember, but I will tell you, this is another piece of advice for other entrepreneurs. So if you start a company with Italians, they like to drink espresso all day. And I tell you from experience, don't try to keep up.
That's very good advice. We'll definitely leave it there. But John, thank you so much. This has been great. We wish you guys all the best. We know MIM's got a lot of great things ahead. So thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah, thank you. It was a pleasure.
I've known John for a very long time and closely followed his career over the years. He has a proven track record of building great companies and then having successful exits. My main takeaway from our interview was that being a serial entrepreneur requires a certain personality. Now, I've heard this in the past, but John has shared with me, he calls himself a startup junkie. And although he says that to be self-deprecating, there's some truth to it. Playing in this space is not for the faint of heart. So one really needs to at least be able to endure, if not enjoy, like he kind of does, the roller coaster, as he called it. This risk, excitement, fear, that he speaks of. Now, I'm no psychiatrist, but I'd imagine that it releases a similar chemical in the brain than it would a high-stakes gambler, which brings the quote from The Gambler from Kenny Rogers to mind. No one to hold him, no one to fold him, no one to walk away, no one to run. John's in it throughout his career has been forced to make all those decisions. He's known when to hold him, stay where he's at, and no one to fold him, and no one to walk away, and nowhere to run, right? So it's interesting. It's an interesting parallel there. The other thing I thought was pretty fascinating that I have not heard before is when he said to be prepared for when every client says yes. Okay. I think most entrepreneurs are prepared for hearing no a lot, but not everyone is prepared for when every client or customer says yes. And quite frankly, that's not a great scenario either. If you're not prepared to meet the demands of your clients, it's a very easy way to alienate customers right out the gates. That's their first experience with your business, is that you don't have the bandwidth to meet their needs. So I did find that very interesting.
Thanks for joining us on Entrepreneurial Insights. If you have enjoyed this, please rate and subscribe to the podcast on Spotify. Email us at missionwealth@ubs.com with comments or suggestions. Visit our website at ubs.com/team/missionwealth, or connect with me on LinkedIn or Twitter at Luke SW Irvin. You've been listening to Entrepreneurial Insights with Luke Irvin at UBS.